Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
So for us coming out today, which were more than 3,000 women and men allies and supporters, we're on the street to say that we are tired. And you're not going to watch us being violated, and there's no legal mechanism or procedure or cases of femicide being taken seriously in the country.
Gender activists call on the Kenyan government to declare femicide a national emergency.
We're looking at the education space, right? So how can we encourage like exchange programs between the diaspora and the continent?
The U.S. government sends a delegation to the ongoing African Nations Cup now underway in Ivory Coast.
Let me confirm that it's true that in the Democratic Progressive Party, we have indeed expelled from membership of the party certain of senior officials of the party, including one of the vice presidents of the party who is a member of parliament.
And Malawi's main opposition Democratic Progressive Party, or DPP, expels some leaders from the group. Who have details? Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Kenya, gender activists and civil society are calling on the government to declare femicide a national emergency in the East African country. In demonstrations in major cities across the country on Saturday, the protesters also demanded expedited action to ensure victims of gender-based violence get justice. Their demands come after reports show an increase in gender-based violence that has left at least 600 women dead between 2016 and 2023, according to Amnesty International. Rachel Mwikali is a prominent gender activist and a leading member of the demonstration against female-targeted violence. She tells me that the judiciary and the other branches of government should do more to protect Kenyan women.
We were out today in solidarity and the fact we exist as women in our own diversity. We say that we are tired of us being killed in the country, and the government is not doing anything. Still, we have seen cases of normalization of violence and targeting women, including sex workers, women human rights defenders, female students, women who are in their marriages, but nothing has been done. And this, we have seen it in the recent cases where we have seen young women being killed. We feel that we have been left alone for us to be butchered, for us to be violated, and the country not taking anything into action. So for us coming out today, which were more than 3,000 women and men allies and supporters, we're on the street to say that we are tired and you're not going to watch us being violated, and there's no legal mechanism or procedure or cases of femicide being taken seriously in the country. And this also was called both to the parliament to act. It's on a weekend, but we just say it's a matter of also one to show also advocacy in terms of saying that we are tired. Us being in the parliament, going to the parliament, was also symbolic to say that they're going to hold our duty bearers accountable as rights holders because we voted for them.
Legally, what do you think the government can do to help stop what you describe as femicide?
One is to take series of cases of femicide seriously in terms of reporting. They should not report femicide as homicide. What they are doing, they're reporting femicide as homicide and murder, which reduces the legitimacy of the court. Secondly, they should support survivors of femicide, the ones who at one point they managed to escape and not being killed, but also you see femicide is linked to gender-based violence, sexual and gender-based violence. So they should ensure there is public safe houses in case a woman feels threatened, they're able to go there to be able to be in a safer space and for legal mechanism to be followed. Sadly, the perpetrators, most of them, they're still out walking free. They are not in remand or in prison.
Your group is calling on the government to declare femicide a national emergency. What will this declaration do for your cause?
When you declare a femicide as a national emergency or disaster, it means it's also being put in the penal code as part of gender-based violence or sexual gender-based violence. Because when you talk about femicide linked to the way I state with sexual gender-based violence, and where if you're not declaring it, it means it encourages men who are violent to continue killing women.
You talk about being disappointed by the judiciary, and there are calls for the authorities to expedite justice for all recent victims of sexual and gender-based violence. But why are you saying that the judiciary has let Kenyan women down.
One, in terms of speeding up the cases, some of these cases are taking too long, which encourages other men to be perpetrators of femicide. And for us, pushing is ensuring that they speed up some of these cases to be able also to give hope to the families that justice is still alive in Kenya. But now what we've been able to see when we started even this struggle more than 5 years ago, so far we have only had 2 cases that are also a lot of CSO that have been able to, and ask feminists and activists, put pressure. And I know now we have one in court for justice for Elizabeth, a woman human rights defender, that was killed. But what does it mean that you have to wait as judiciary to get public pressure for you to process the case or speed up the case? That's not right. That's also an exclusive point of access to justice. And access to justice should be very inclusive. But how you're seeing with the judiciary, they are moving too slow. And also with the interior security, they're moving too slow in terms of also apprehending some of these perpetrators, because the only ones that we have been able to see in public is the ones that have gotten the media limelight. But we have many cases that go unreported and they have not gotten the media limelight. So it's also up to judiciary acting on its own, and also interior security, because when you talk about interior security, also includes also the police. And the police are the ones who are involved in terms of criminal wrong. And criminal wrong includes some of killing of women.
Rachel Mwikali is a prominent gender activist and a leading member of the demonstration against female-targeted violence. She spoke with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. The military regimes in Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger announced Sunday their immediate withdrawal from the West African bloc, ECOWAS. The leaders of the 3 Sahel nations issued a statement saying it was a sovereign decision to leave the Economic Community of West African States without delay. Struggling with jihadist violence and poverty, the regimes have had tense ties with ECOWAS since coups took place in Niger last July, Burkina Faso in 2022, and Mali in 2020. All 3 were suspended from ECOWAS, with Niger and Mali facing heavy sanctions. They have hardened their positions in recent months and joined forces in an alliance of Sahel states. A French military withdrawal from the Sahel, the region along the Sahara Desert across Africa, has heightened concerns over the conflict spreading southward to Gulf of Guinea state, Ghana, Togo, Benin, and Ivory Coast. The prime minister, appointed by Niger's military regime on Thursday, blasted ECOWAS for bad faith after the bloc largely shunned a planned meeting in Niamey. Niger had hoped for an opportunity to talk through differences with fellow state of ECOWAS, which has cold-shouldered Niamey, imposing heavy economic and financial sanctions following the military coup that overthrew elected President Mohamed Bazoum. The U.S. government sent a delegation to the ongoing African Nations Cup, or AFCON, now underway in Ivory Coast. It was led by Denise Laurent-Mante, the executive director of the Presidential Advisory Council on African Diaspora Engagement in the United States. Experts say it's the first U.S. official delegation to Africa's premier football tournament. While in Ivory Coast, the delegation engaged U.S. international partners, civil society, and Ivorian youth, leveraging the unifying power of sport to strengthen ties between Americans and African partners. For more information on the Presidential Advisory Council on African Diaspora Engagement in the United States, I sat down with Denise Laurent-Mante, Presidential Advisory Council Executive Director on African Diaspora Engagement in the United States. Here is the conclusion of the conversation.
What would you say were the major takeaways for you while you were down there in terms of the engagements you had with the sports community, the civil society, the government officials you met? What were some of the major takeaways?
So I would say, I said before, you know, sports is a unifying factor. Mm-hmm. Sports and cultural diplomacy is something that I think the U.S. does a great job at. You know, when it comes to sports, our culture is very rich, especially when it comes to the African diaspora. Mm-hmm. And so we want to leverage that. You know, it's our source of strength. strength. And we saw that. There was an event we had at our U.S. Embassy in Abidjan with the three sports icons. And Lisa Leslie got quite emotional because one of the students talked about, you know, how much of, you know, a role model, you know, she has been to them, you know, over the years, because she's broken certain barriers, you know, in her line of work, as, you know, coming from a single person, you know, family, you know, being raised in, you know, California, et cetera. And they talked about how much she's inspired them, but she got emotional because she was saying that her being here has actually inspired her. Right. You know, coming to the continent for the first time, listening to the things that they had to say, you know, inspired her.
So talk to me about what this year looks for you as you engage the African diaspora. What are some of the things you're looking at implementing this year?
Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're excited. The council's up and running. You know, it's only been up and running for a few months now. Right. But we already have a list of priorities that we're hoping to move forward. We're looking at the education space. Right. So how can we encourage like exchange programs between the diaspora and the continent? I was just talking to a colleague that, you know, historically there's always been a strong connection between, you know, African scholars in the United States. In fact, some of the former heads of state on the continent, some of them, you know, went to school here.
Right.
You know, Kwame Nkrumah went to Lincoln University and HBCU. So there's always been that historical connection when it comes to education in particular. It's an area where we want to leverage, right? And I think amplify. And so looking at exchange programs between African universities and HBCUs, how can we encourage more cross collaboration, right? Talked about sports, talked about the sports cultural diplomacy side of things, also the trade and investment space. You know, there's a youth bulge on the continent. Looking at the digital sector, right? When it comes to emerging technologies, how can we leverage that? You know, as the world is becoming more African, Africa's continent is also very young. And the United States is a leader when it comes to technology. And so how can we also encourage collaboration in that space in particular? But I would say these are some of the areas that we're focusing on now, at least in the short term. Of course, there's a lot more to do when it comes to engaging the diaspora and our African partners. But I would say at least for these core spaces, we're looking at seeing how we could, you know, do more in that space. But of course, there's always more to do in the human rights and governance space as well. You know, in everything that we do, right, the society has to be, I think, you know, free and fair, has to be ripe. Government policies have to work. And so that's also always going to be a priority, you know, in terms of creating the foundation for education, for trade and investment, for the digital transformation space as well.
And the president, the current president of Sierra Leone attended school here as well.
He did as well.
Right.
Yeah. So there's, you know, there's this connection when it comes to education in particular. And so I think that has been a reoccurring theme for me with the council. Everyone talks about education. And so it's something that we're looking very closely at.
Talk to me about investment, because Africa usually will be telling you that, okay, we need more partnership, we need more investment. It's not about aid. They want more investment in their countries to create the opportunities for the youth. So is there anything you are looking at in terms of investment?
Yeah, you know, and something I said earlier was that we're looking at not just what we're going to do in Africa, but with Africa.
Right.
And so we're at that phase right now where partnership is key, you know, and, you know, there are a lot of great Black-owned businesses in the United States, great businesses that are owned by African immigrants, you know? And so what better way to partner with some of those businesses, right? Some of them are looking at ways to expand those businesses. Why not go to the continent, right? And so we're encouraging that across different sectors, whether it's agriculture, whether it's technology, or even merging, you know, agriculture and technology, right? There's a lot of opportunities there. And the youth being at the forefront of everything. There's something that I always say is that the currency of this generation is Africa's creativity. You know, Africa's youth, they're very talented, very creative. In Nigeria alone, the amount of talent coming out of Nigeria is astounding, right? And so, you know, the ideas are there, right? The content is there. And then when you partner that creativity and the content with some of the great work we're doing here in the United States, you get something amazing. Mm. You know, I always say some of the great fintech ideas started in Nairobi, Kenya. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of great talent when it comes to technology in Kenya, for example, right? And we are doing a great job in that space. And so as we partner with Africa, whether it's Africa's youth, whether it's a diaspora-owned business, a black-owned business, I think it's guaranteed to really create something that is going to be, you know, amazing, but to also achieve global objectives, right? Mm-hmm. Solve global challenges, solve global problems.
Denise Laurent-Mante is the Executive Director of the Presidential Advisory Council on African Diaspora Engagement in the United States. She spoke with me from here in Washington. Political observers are expressing concern that if tensions between Somalia and Ethiopia are not promptly resolved, the entire Horn of Africa could be destabilized. The concern follows the recent agreement between breakaway Somaliland and Ethiopia, which will give Addis Ababa direct access to the Red Sea in return for recognition of the breakaway Somali state as an independent country. Somalia rejects the agreement, saying it infringes on its sovereignty. It has since passed a law to nullify the agreement. For analysis on the current situation, I reach Matthew Bryden. He is the co-founder and strategic advisor at the Sahan Research Think Tank.
Well, it certainly looked as though those tensions sort of polarized the region, with Somalia trying to appeal to allies across the region, from Egypt to Qatar to other states, Turkey, looking for support, also seeking to raise the issue with the African Union and the UN Security Council. On the other hand, there are some indications that perhaps Somalia is cooling down somewhat and is sending more calibrated diplomatic messages. President Hassan Sheikh was speaking at the inauguration of one of his federal member state presidents today, saying that Somalia doesn't seek conflict with Ethiopia. So the ball is in Ethiopia's court, and that Somalia will wait to see what Ethiopia does. So until recently, we've seen this polarization across the region, with Somalia calling Ethiopia an aggressor and threatening to take action and mobilize forces, but now perhaps starting to walk back some of that rhetoric.
Initially, some people were wondering why Somalia was so angry following the announcement of the MOU signed between Somaliland and Ethiopia that will give Ethiopia access to the Red Sea.
Well, on the face of it, Somalia was angry because Ethiopia struck a deal with a government in a territory that Somalia considers to be part of the Federal Republic of Somalia. So striking a very important strategic and economic deal without the federal government's knowledge or consent. Because Somaliland considers itself to be an independent nation, Somaliland, of course, would not agree to Somalia being involved in such a deal directly. The other reason that Somalia was so incensed is that Ethiopia, the messaging around the memorandum of understanding that was signed between Ethiopia and Somaliland, indicated that Ethiopia was considering recognizing Somaliland as a sovereign state, which would signal you know, the formal breakup of the Somali Republic. But it's also important to note that you know, Somalia didn't have a functioning government for much of the last 30 years. And naturally, this issue was going to come up at some point. There have been more than 12 rounds of talks between Somalia and Somaliland over the last decade, and Somalia has never taken these seriously or provided any kind of roadmap for the determination of Somaliland's final status. So again, if Somaliland had no political options through dialogue with Somalia, then of course it was going to seek unilateral recognition from other states, and Ethiopia appears willing to oblige. So Mogadishu has every reason to be angry, but at the same time could have headed this off, or forestalled it, by acting sooner and with greater seriousness than it has on the issue of Somaliland.
What are your thoughts about reaction from neighboring countries in the Horn of Africa? We've heard Egypt, coming to support Somalia's action, saying that it will not allow any country to infringe on its sovereignty. But what are your thoughts about reactions in the region?
Well, it's very hard to read, partly because what we've seen from most countries, both in the region and in Europe and the United States, have been what I would characterize as boilerplate statements, essentially that they recognize the unity, sovereignty, and territorial integrity of Somalia and call for dialogue and a de-escalation of tensions. Now, that's exactly what you would expect, because that is those are fundamental norms of the international order. But on the other hand, you have some countries that clearly do stand with Somalia, such as Egypt and Qatar, and maybe they're indicating that they can provide military support or financial support. It's not yet clear whether they will follow through on pledges or commitments. But then we also have states that are quite sympathetic to Somaliland. There are a number of African governments that have received visits from the Somaliland head of state in the past and have shown an interest in recognition. So despite the sort of bland messaging from the international community, I think if the MOU goes forward, if the dispute continues to escalate, we may see with greater clarity where governments actually stand on the matter.
Matthew Bryden is the co-founder and strategic advisor at the Sahan Research Think Tank. He spoke with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
United Nations says almost one in three women continue to be subjected to physical and or sexual intimate partner violence at least once in their lives. On this week's edition of Our Voices, we will discuss whether existing laws on violence against women are effective enough to criminalize forms of domestic violence in sub-Saharan Africa. Join the conversation Wednesdays at 1900 UTC on the Voice of America.
A parliamentarian from the Opposition Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC, is calling for reconciliation and unity among the rank-and-file members of the party. Yusuf Isibambi, the chief executive and chief whip of the FDC in parliament, says the group's only choice is to unite ahead of the next general election scheduled for 2026. His remarks follow reports of a recent leadership dispute that observers say is threatening to weaken and break apart the opposition party. Analysts say failure to heed the call could weaken the FDC's electoral prospect. Parliamentarian Yusuf Isibambi tells me that the party has time to effectively implement reconciliation efforts to unite the party before the general election.
Yeah, we really have no option. As a party and as leaders, we have to be one. Of course, there are issues which are still causing some bit of a problem in terms of understanding each other. But we really have no option because we are representatives of the people. The country is under hostage. The economy is on its knees. The laws themselves to do with human rights abuse, electoral reforms, and specific constitutional reforms are directed by the Supreme Court, and the IPOD being an umbrella group for all political parties, including the NRM, suggested and proposed so many reforms. Now, if we are not united as a force, as FDC, we have nothing to present on the table. So we have really to talk and meet and ensure that we have a reconciliation.
Do you think the party leadership as it is now is doing enough for this call that you are making to actualize?
We are trying to do it at a level of the parliamentary caucus. And the caucus is really a strong organ, which is stipulated in our constitution but also as leaders who are respectable. So I think if we resolve whatever issues at the parliamentary caucus, we definitely have to force our leaders to understand what is going on and the group which is seated at Katonga.
Some supporters of the FDC I spoke with said the leadership must take decisive and expedited steps and come up with measures or policies that could unite the party and discourage factionalism. Do you think that the call is appropriate?
Yeah, the call is very appropriate. Even the leaders at the working committee this week, unfortunately, the party president did not attend, but had delegated leadership to the deputy, Eastern Miss Okuri. And I think the consensus is that it definitely it should be taken upon by the leadership to ensure that there's a reconciliation. And the group of elders are also doing it because, you see, the issues raised are not resolved in the hearts of some of the leaders. So I think that has to be worked on. And you have no option. They also have no option.
What do you say to those who are saying the genesis of the problem is the lack of trust in the leadership and that there were allegations of some financial impropriety or funds belonging to the party that allegedly were misused? Is this a situation of disinformation, misinformation, or attempt to destabilize the FDC?
Yeah, that issue or whatever allegations were investigated by a committee appointed by the National Council. It was also considered at the National Council meeting. And I think in principle, it's an issue which can still be handled by the Elders Committee. And I'm sure it will be resolved without any problem. However, I think now the biggest problem lies with the fact that the group at Katonga boycotted the delegates' conference. And as such, the people in control, basically the people at Najana Nkumbi, and the other good leaders out of leadership until after 5 years. I hear they want to organize their own delegates' conference in March, which I think lacks legitimacy in light of what was decided by court. And the fact that the Electoral Commission has already acknowledged the leadership at Najana Nkumbi. So I think that's where we have a dilemma.
What do you think are the prospects of this reconciliation and unity that you are talking about ahead of the 2026 general election? Do you think there's even enough time for a united...
Yeah, I think there's enough time. And it's just for people to bend a little bit backwards. And personally, I've already expressed my concern about it. We don't want to lose the good leaders who are in parliament, because with this kind of atmosphere, it'd be very difficult for you to beat the NRM or even other opposition parties if you are divided. But I think we are now midterm, so we have ample time to ensure that at least we reconcile and also mobilize for other structures in the party.
Yusuf Isibambi is the chief whip of the Opposition Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC, in Parliament. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. In Malawi, the main opposition Democratic Progressive Party, or DPP, plans to fill senior level positions following the expulsion of some members of the group. The expelled members include former Minister of Information, Parliamentarian Mark Botomani, former leader of the opposition in Parliament, Kondwani Nankumwa, former Minister of Homeland Security, Nicholas Dausi, and former National Director of Women in the DPP, Cecilia Chazama. But critics say the expulsion was too harsh, describing the move as dictatorial. Analysts say the expulsions could destabilize the party and may affect its electoral prospects in the next general election. For more information about the latest update, I reach Charles Mango. He is the Director of Legal Affairs in the DPP.
Let me confirm that it's true that in the Democratic Progressive Party, we have indeed expelled from membership of the party certain senior officials of the party. including one of the vice presidents of the party who is a member of parliament, as well as a leader of opposition. But we've expelled them from the party because they had committed serious violation of the constitution by holding what I would call the National Executive Committee of the party, which in our party we call National Governing Council, which was not authorized by the Central Committee and was not authorized by the President, His Excellency Professor Arthur Peter Mutharika.
What happens to the parliamentary seat of Mark Botomani, the former information minister, and as well as Mr. Nankuva, who was the minority leader in parliament? What happens to their position in parliament after expelling them from the party?
According to the Constitution of the Republic of Malawi, it says that if a party expels its members from its membership, a person who is a member of parliament, that member of parliament ceases to be representing that party in parliament and therefore becomes, what I would say, independent in parliament. So in principle, these members of parliament, including Honorable Nankuma, Honorable Botomani, you've just mentioned, who had another one, Honorable Nicholas Dahusi, all of them, the three of them who are members of parliament have been expelled. Therefore, they'll be free to sit in the independent benches of the National Assembly here in Malawi. Or they can sit anywhere they want while in parliament, but they cannot represent or speak for the Democratic Progressive Party any longer.
Doesn't the party executive realize that perhaps this will divide the party further instead of reconciling and moving the party forward? Wouldn't this destabilize the party?
I can say to you and to the listeners that there was a lot of destabilization within the PPP because of the people who have been expelled. Actually, there was no peace in the party, there was no unity in the party, and there was no sense of direction of the party because of some of the people who have been expelled. It was like a cancer which was eating part of the body of the TPP. So in principle, if you have been diagnosed to have a cancer in the leg or in any part of the body which you can do away with, you would rather get rid of the cancer than allow the cancer to eat the whole of your body and you die.
So where does the DPP go from here following this expulsion that many say could even thwart the electoral prospect of the party in the next general election?
Let me say that the DPP is the main opposition party here in Malawi. However, I will just cite the case of Honorable Nankuma, who was the leader of opposition, or who is the leader of the opposition until being expelled from the party, that he was acting without any sense of direction from the party, or indeed from the leadership of the party. So he was not consulting anybody. He was doing the role of opposition as if he's not belonging to any political party, or indeed as if he's got any leader that could lead or direct the policies of the party. As a result, we reached a situation in Malawi where the opposition was very ineffective, dysfunctional, if I were to say that, and not only affecting the welfare of the TPP as a party, but indeed, in my opinion, affecting the welfare of all Malawians, well-meaning Malawians, who would have loved to have an effective opposition in Malawi, which would keep the government in check and balance. But we failed to do that because of the disunity, because of the dysfunctionality, which was there because of this division.
Charles Mango is the Director of Legal Affairs in Malawi's main opposition Democratic Progressive Party, or DPP. He spoke with me from the Malawian capital, Lilongwe.
Hi, this is Larry London from Border Crossings, and I have a very special guest coming on my show for the Artist Spotlight of the Week next Tuesday, which is January 30th. I'd like to welcome singer-songwriter, Brit Award winner, multi-platinum artist, he's got over a billion streams, James Arthur. He'll be joining us on Border Crossings at 1500 Universal. Please join us as well on VOA Africa.
Being the preferred choice of footwear for many, flip-flops, typically made of plastic or rubber, break easily and don't get disposed of properly. Millions of them, therefore, end up in oceans, waterways, dump sites, and landfills all over the world. A Kenya-based company has found creative and functional ways to reuse them. VOA Nairobi Bureau Chief Mariama Diallo visited their warehouse located in Karen, about 45 minutes from the city center, and has this report.
Hundreds of thousands of discarded flip-flops arrive regularly at Ocean Soul, a Kenyan-based company. Joe Mwakiremba has been working for the company for about 10 years.
Ocean Soul was founded on the premise of cleaning our oceans and waterways, at the same time employing lots of artists from high-impact communities here in Kenya.
He says flip-flops are collected from weekly beach cleanups, waterways and dump sites and brought into their warehouse. They weigh the material and pay collectors about 18 cents per kilogram. Then, to prepare them for carving, they are first hand-washed one flip-flop at a time.
The next stage for our smaller and medium sculptures, we have a die-cut machine that will punch out a template of a giraffe or a lion or a rhino. Those templates are joined together with glue, then carved out into that respective animal.
For life-size pieces, the company reuses an additional material.
Our bigger sculptures on the inside, they use the polystyrene material. These come from shipping companies. They use them as insulation. When they get worn out, they throw them away. So the inside of the bigger pieces is this material carved out into the shape of the giraffe or elephant, then padded with the flip-flops.
Using a machine, the pieces are then sanded before being cleaned again and readied for shipment. Florence Auma is an artist who's been working for the company for 14 years. She had to learn the art of carving from scratch.
Started with washing, and then I started with blocking. And then I am the first female carver in this company. So I was carving. Now I am happy because I have so many things. I have many skills in this company.
Skills that have allowed her to be able to carve just about anything, like these coasters, and to travel the world to showcase her talent. Mwakiremba told us one of the largest pieces they made was a life-size car for a Honda dealership in Huntsville, Alabama, that took 2,500 flip-flops and 3 months to make. Ocean Soul is now collaborating with a design artist from Uganda who lives in Finland and owns a gallery there in one of their biggest projects to date. Lincoln Kaiwa, who's used materials such as ceramic, granite, wood, and glass, has decided to try something new with flip-flops. He recently traveled to Kenya to finalize a furniture project to be launched in April during Milan Design Week in Italy.
The project, it has 14 different pieces, so you're just seeing just three of them. Of course, it's a win-win situation. The more flip-flops are used, it means that the more flip-flops that have been taken out of the environment. For me, that's the meaning of sustainability.
In 2023, the company recycled 750,000 flip-flops. This year, it aims to recycle 1 million. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs, and music from our African collection. But first, now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. All Africans everywhere should express their deep appreciation for the achievements of the South African government and people. You know, in difficult circumstances as in Gaza and the occupied West Bank, the question is, who will bail the cats? The South African government, believing that its own sad history under apartheid and the shifting of population and their land is similar to the experience of the Palestinian people in Gaza and the West Bank. So they stepped forward and said that they would bail the cats. They submitted a well-reasoned legal brief which says that Israel is on the verge of committing genocide. On Friday, the International Court of Justice gave its ruling. That ruling showed clearly that the South African case has been endorsed by the courts. In a clinical reasoning by the majority of the courts, they accepted some of the case of the court. First, they said that South Africa has a standing before the courts on the issue of genocide. They also established that there was and exists a dispute between Israel and South Africa on the issue relating to genocide convention. They also established and agreed that South Africa, through its legal reasoning, proves that there is clear intent on the government of Israel to commit genocide. And because of these acceptance of this South African claim and the challenge of Israel, the court proceeded to deal with the issue of provisional measures that was required of the court by South Africa. In a clinical reasoning by the courts, one after another, the court gave its orders. These six provisional measures are binding on the state of Israel. What one has to bear in mind is that the courts made it clear that the practice of the court is not to use the exact wording of the applicant, South Africa. They can phrase the issue in their own terms. But it is very clear that all of the demands of South Africa were endorsed by the courts, a major achievement. And in addition, the courts established that there is a prima facie for genocide by Israel. It is sad indeed that despite this achievement, some in the media have tried to request for something which, if they know the law, could not be done by the courts. The courts is not a political forum like the Security Council or the General Assembly. So the court could not call for what South Africa wanted, calling for ceasefire. But to make much of this by the media they are doing, it's a lack of knowledge of how courts operate. Africans should not be distracted by this kind of maneuver in the media. Rather, they should take into account certain decisions of the courts. The court demanded that Israel within 1 month should present a report on its application, implementation of its mandate and order. And that submission by Israel, if they do comply, will be sent to the government of South Africa and then ask both of them to present their views, and the court will make a ruling. This is the most successful accountability that the court has made. So don't really be distracted by this and others. History will not erase the fact that the World Court did find those orders necessary. Quite frankly, we should not beat about the bush. There were many who were hoping that they would have a division among the 15 judges of the courts, but they were disappointed. In all of these six orders of the courts, it was either 15 against 2, 6 against 1, and it was almost unanimous. Of course, there were those who were hoping there would be a divided court. Some were even saying the Europeans in the court would not agree with South Africa. They were disappointed. Many also were expecting for not only a divided court, but together with some dissenting opinion among the members. This would have muddied the situation. But today, it's very clear. One should not confuse what I will call stringent, defiant words and abuse in the political arena to what appears in the court of law. The World Court is not a self-enforcing institution, and its orders and findings are now to be dealt in another forum, either the Security Council or the General Assembly. In fact, there is a process on the way when soon some states will go to the Security Council, and in light of the findings of the court, they can ask for a ceasefire. And we must listen more to the Foreign Minister of South Africa, who was being prompted by the media to say that she was disappointed. She said, no, you will not get me to say that South Africa is disappointed. And she correctly said that Israel will not be able to accept all of the orders of the court without some form of cessation of hostility. It could not be done. So the fact that the court didn't mention does not mean they rejected it. They understood better than most of the journalists that you could not do it without cessation of hostility. And let me pay some respect for the judges of the court. It should be acknowledged that all the justices of the judges are international civil servants who are pledged to act with complete impartiality and integrity. They have done a good job. And South Africa has acted in the name of humanity. And the rest will be left not only to the political forum, but the public opinion of the global community. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent. Took some shots and balled out, now how the star tastes. I can't even go inside my own mic here. I might need to hit the town, I need you right here, right here. Till she reached in the trunk and found a Nina. I told her, baby, that's Nina Simone. Driving through the liquor store, faded, braided, hands in the waving, AZ, 80s like the 90s and 2000s. Driving through this wildin', ayy. Brady 7 pack, they come in bunch. I've been with the choir on a high note, getting C notes. Different presentation to this vibe, you need a keynote. Prezi round this, I ain't sending vetoes. Ain't no stopping, been stopping, lick some boys on Geo. Batting out the 504, I say the name is Creo. Dallas, when I'm on the road, I get to go in T.O. Dominatrix matrix when she do it like I'm Neo. This other side, cause they locking. Mama said, live up to my name, but they jocking. They gon' try, go and take your face for the profit. They gon' lie, they gon' slip and slide, get beside ya. They gon' try, we 100 deep like Verizon. In the trees with the bumblebees on horizon. And catching Z's, I been in the V on road to Zion. Set they souls, I been in that mode that I ain't buying.
He ain't slaughter gang, then he ain't official. Yeah. When that chopper sing, you really think that they gon' miss you. I spent a $500,000 on dismissals. It's gonna be a hearse, not a verse if I dish you. Got me, got me. When I send it past the ceiling, that stuck up. All that talking, acting tough, get you roughed up. If your wifey at the spot, she getting bust up. Rich, got my scrap from Tommy Hill figure. Red, white, and blue American, I kill. Spray is blocking and pull off, this a real dipper. Bottega pick my kind, but I'm a field. Oh God. I be sitting inside the house cause I don't feel. Baby, but my baby like the drill.
Baby, yeah.
Claustrophobic, I don't even like to chill with them. 21. Guess I'm facing, say everybody say they real.
Oh God.
Got a whooping, but you still ain't learned your lesson, huh? Hard headed, you won't end up on the stretcher, huh? Oh, you usher now, you giving out confessions, huh? On the blogs like these, oh, you messy, huh? Put a Louis logo on my switch. I know Virgil probably looking down like down this. Back on that 21. Back inside the club with my blick. 21. Playing freeze tag, I'm trying to see who it.
Oh God.
Say we ox when they see me, don't do.
Oh God.
Only person believe that you a killer is your
21.
Making diss songs, died about a diss
fact.
If I see my ox while I'm in cuffs, then I'ma spit. Wanna kill the world about your, cause she on
21.
Thinking about the that I'ma on while I piss.
21.
You ain't heard my music while you balling up your fist. 21. Reverb on the chip.
As I lay me down, heaven hear me now.
I'm lost without a cause. After giving it my all, winter storms have come and darkened my sun. After all that I've been through, who on earth can I turn to? I look to you. Searching for that open door, and every road that I've taken led to my regret, and I don't know if I'm gonna make it. Nothing to do but lift my head. I look to you. I look to you.
Gotta take a little time, a little time to think things over. I better read between the lines in case I need it when I'm colder. Hey, in my life there's been a heartache and pain. I don't if I can face it again. Can't stop now, I've traveled so far to change this lonely life. I wanna know what love is. I want you to show me.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English to Africa service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, including producer Nicole Peters and engineer the great Justin Thwaite, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, the lion and the sheep may lie down together, but the sheep will not get any sleep. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.